Chapter 21. "Now that you have our undivided attention," Pitt said dryly, "you mind sharing your revelation?" Redfern shook his head as if to clear it. "The story, saga is a better definition, is overwhelming. I can't quite comprehend it all." Lily asked, "Do the tablets tell why a Greco-Roman ship sailed far beyond her home waters?" "Not Greco-Roman, but Byzantine," Redfern corrected her. "When the Serapis sailed the ancient world, the seat of the empire had been moved by Constantine the Great from Rome to the Bosporus, where the Greek city of Byzantium once stood." "Which became Constantinople," said Pitt. "And then Istanbul." Redfern turned to Lily. "Sorry for not giving you a direct answer, but yes, the tablets reveal how and why the ship came here. To fully explain, we have to set the stage, beginning with 323 B.C., the year Alexander the Great died in Babylon. His empire was split up by his generals. One of them, Ptolemy, carved out Egypt and became king. A canny guy, Ptolemy. He also managed to get his hands on Alexander's corpse, encasing it in a gold and crystal coffin. He later enshrined the body in an elegant mausoleum and built a magnificent city around it that surpassed Athens. In honor of his former king, Ptolemy called it Alexandria. What does all this have to do with the Serapis? Asked Lily. Please bear with me, replied Redfern genially. Ptolemy founded a massive museum and library from scratch. The inventory became monumental. His descendants, through Cleopatra and later successors, all continued to acquire manuscripts and art objects until the museum, and especially the library, became one of the largest storehouses of art, science, and literature that has ever existed. This vast collection of knowledge lasted until A.D. 391. In that year, Emperor Theodosius and the Patriarch of Alexandria, Theophilus, who was a religious nutcase, decided all reference to anything except newly formed Christian principles was paganism. They masterminded the destruction of the library's contents. Statues, fabulous works of art in marble, bronze, gold, and ivory, incredible paintings and tapestries, countless numbers of books inscribed on lambskin or papyrus scrolls, even Alexander's corpse, all were to be smashed into dust or burned to ashes. What kind of numbers are we talking about? Pitt asked. The books alone numbered in the hundreds of thousands. Lily shook her head sadly. What a terrible waste. Only biblical and church writings were left, continued Redfern. The entire library and museum was finally leveled after Arab and Islamic armies swept Egypt sometime around A.D. 646. The earlier masterworks that took centuries to collect were lost. Gone forever, Pitt summed up. Lost, Redfern agreed. So historians have thought until now. But if what I just read rings true, the cream of the collection is not gone forever. It lies hidden somewhere. Lily was confused. It exists to this day, smuggled out of Alexandria by the Serapis before the burning? According to the inscriptions on the tablets. Pitt looked doubtful. No way the Serapis sneaked off with more than a tiny fraction of the collection. It won't wash. The ship is too small. Less than 40 tons burden. The crew might have crammed a few thousand scrolls and a couple of statues into the cargo hold, but nothing like the quantity you're talking about. Redfern gave Pitt a respectful gaze. You're very astute. You have a good knowledge of early ships. Well, let's get back to the Serapis washing up in Greenland, Pitt urged, as Redfern picked up the appropriate pages of Lily's text and shuffled them into order. I won't give you a literal translation of 4th-century Latin, too stiff and formal. Instead, I'll try and relate the text in English vernacular. The first entry is under the Julian calendar date of April 3rd, A.D. 391. The report begins, I, Cucius Rufinus, captain of the Serapis, in the employ of Nicias, Greek shipping merchant of the port city of Rhodes, have agreed to transport a cargo for Junius Venator of Alexandria. The voyage is said to be long and arduous, and Venator will not disclose our destination. My daughter Hypatia sailed with me this trip, and her mother will be very concerned at our lengthy separation. But Venator is paying 20 times the usual rate, a good fortune that will greatly benefit Nicias as well as myself and the crew. The cargo was put on board at night under heavy guard, and quite mysteriously, as I was ordered to remain at the docks with my crew during the loading. Four soldiers under the command of the centurion Domitius Severus have been commanded to stay on the ship and sail with us. I do not like the look of it, but Venator has paid me for the voyage in full, and I cannot go back on my contract." "An honest man," said Pitt. "Hard to believe he didn't discover the nature of his cargo." "He comes to that later. The next few lines are a log of the voyage. He also makes mention of his ship's namesake. I'll skip to where they make their first port. I thank our god Serapis for providing us with a smooth and fast passage of 14 days to Cartago Nova, where we rested for 5 days and took on 4 times our normal supply of provisions. Here we joined Junius Venator's other ships. Most are over 200 tons burden, some close to 300. We total 16 with Venator's flagship. Our sturdy Serapis is the smallest vessel in the fleet." "A fleet!" Lily cried. Her eyes gleamed, her whole body taut. "They did save the collection." Redfern nodded delightedly. "A damn good chunk of it, anyway. 200 to 300 ton ships were representative of large merchantmen of that era. Allowing for 2 ships to carry men and provisions, and taking an average tonnage of 200 for the other 14 ships, you have a gross tonnage for the fleet of 2,800 tons. Enough to transport 1/3 of the library's books and a fair share of the museum's art treasures." Pitt called for a break. He went to the galley counter and brought back 2 cups of coffee. He set one in front of Lily and returned for a plate of doughnuts. He remained standing. He thought and concentrated better on his feet. "So far the great library snatch is theory," he said. "I've heard nothing that proves the goods were actually spirited away." "Rufinus nails it down further on," said Redfern. "The description of the Serapis's cargo comes near the end of the log." Pitt gave the marine archaeologist an impatient look and sat back, waiting. On the next tablet, Rufinus mentions minor repairs to the ship, dockside gossip, and a tourist's eye of Cartago Nova, now Cartagena, Spain. Oddly, he doesn't express any further uneasiness about the coming voyage. He even failed to note the date the fleet left port. But the really offbeat part is the censorship. Listen to the next paragraph. "We sailed today toward Great Sea. The faster ships towing the slower ones. I can write no more. The soldiers are watching. Under strict orders of Junius Venator, there can be no record of the voyage." "Just when we set the straight pieces of the puzzle together," Pitt muttered, "the center section is missing." "There must be more," Lily insisted. "I know I copied beyond that part of the report."
"You did," acknowledged Redfern, shuffling the pages. "Rufinus takes up the tale 11 months later. I am free now to record our cruel voyage without fear of punishment. Venator and his small army of slaves, Severus and his legionaries, all the ship's crews, have all been slain by the barbarians and the fleet burned. The Serapis escaped because my fear of Venator made me cautious. I learned the source and contents of the fleet's cargo and know its hiding place in the hills. Secrets such as these must be kept from mortal men. I suspected Venator and Severus meant to murder all but a few of their trusted soldiers and the crew of 1 ship to ensure their return home. I feared for the life of my daughter, so I armed my crew and ordered them to remain close to the ship so we could cast off at the first sign of treachery. But the barbarians struck first, slaughtering Venator's slaves and Severus's legion. Our guards died in the battle, and we cut the lines and heaved our ship from the beach. Venator tried to save himself by running into the water. He shouted for rescue. I could not risk the lives of Hypatia and the crew to save him, and refused to turn back. To do so against the current would have been suicidal. Redfern paused in the translation before continuing. At this point, Rufinus jumps around and flashes back to the fleet's departure from Cartagena. The voyage from Hispania to our destination in the strange land took 58 days. The weather was favorable with winds at our backs. For this good fortune, Serapis demanded a sacrifice. 2 of our crew died from a malady unknown to me.
He must mean scurvy, said Lily.
Ancient seamen rarely sailed more than 1 or 2 weeks without touching land, Pitt clarified. Scurvy did not become common until the long voyages of the Spanish. Could be they died from any number of reasons.
Lily nodded at Redfern. Sorry for interrupting. Please go on.
We first stepped ashore on a large island inhabited by barbarians who resembled Scythians, but with darker skins. They proved friendly and willingly helped the fleet replenish our food and fresh water supplies. We sighted more islands, but the flagship sailed on. Only Venator knew where the fleet was to land. At last we sighted a barren shore and came to the wide mouth of a river. We stood off for 5 days and nights until the winds blew to our advantage. Then we set sail up the river, rowing at times, until we reached the hills of Rome.
The hills of Rome, Lily repeated absently. That's a twist.
He must have meant it as a comparison, said Pitt. A tough riddle to crack, Redfern admitted. The slaves under the overseer Latinius Macer dug into the hills above the river. 8 months later, the fleet's cargo was carried from the ships to the hiding ground.
Did he describe the hiding ground? Asked Pitt.
Redfern picked up a tablet and compared it to Lily's copy.
Parts of the wording are indistinct. I'll have to fill in as best I can.
Thus, the secret of the secrets lies within the hill inside a chamber dug by the slaves. The place cannot be seen because of the palisade. After all was stored, the barbarian horde swarmed from the hills. I do not know if the chamber was sealed in time, as I was busy helping my crew push the boat from the sand.
Rufinus fails to record distances, said Pitt, disillusioned, and never gives directions.
Now we have an odds-on chance the barbarians, whoever the hell they were, robbed the store.
Redfern's expression turned grim.
We can't ignore that possibility.
I don't think the worst happened, said Lily optimistically. An immense collection can't be erased as though it never existed. A few pieces would have eventually turned up.
Depends on the area where the action took place, said Pitt. 58 days at an average speed of, say, 3.5 knots. A vessel designed along the ancient lines of the Serapis might have sailed over 4,000 nautical miles.
Providing they sailed in a straight line, said Redfern.
Not a likely prospect. Rufinus merely states they sailed 58 days before stepping ashore. Traveling in unknown waters, they probably hugged the coastlines.
But traveling to where? Lily asked.
The southern coast of western Africa is the most logical destination, answered Redfern. A crew of Phoenicians sailed around Africa clockwise in the 5th century B.C. Quite a bit of it was charted by Rufinus's time. Stands to reason Venator would have turned his fleet south after passing through the Straits of Gibraltar.
Never sell a jury, said Pitt. Rufinus described islands.
Could be the Madeira, Canary, or Cape Verde Islands.
Still won't sell.
You can't explain how the Serapis ended up halfway across the globe from the tip of Africa to Greenland.
You're talking a distance of 8,000 miles.
That's true. I'm confused on that count.
My vote goes for a northern course, said Lily. The islands also might be the Shetlands or the Faroes. That would put the excavation site along the Norwegian coast, or better yet, Iceland.
She makes a good case, Pitt agreed. Her theory would explain how the Serapis came to be stranded in Greenland.
What does Rufinus tell us after he escaped the barbarians? She asked.
Redfern paused to finish off his hot chocolate. He goes on to say, we reached the open sea. Navigating was difficult. The stars are in different positions. The sun is not the same also. Violent storms struck us from the south. One crewman was swept overboard on the 10th day, a Gaul. We continued to be driven toward the north. On the 31st day, our god led us to a safe bay where we made repairs and took what provisions we could find from the land. We also added extra ballast stone. Some distance beyond the beach there is a great sea of dwarf-like pines. Fresh water seeps from sand with the jab of a stick. 6 days of good sailing and then another tempest, worse than the last. Our sails are split and useless. The great gale shattered the mast, and the steering oars were swept away. We drifted helplessly under the merciless wind for many days. I lost record of days. Sleep became impossible. The weather turned very cold. Ice formed on the deck. The ship became very unstable. I ordered my frozen and exhausted crew to throw our water and wine jars over the side. The amphoras you found on the bottom outside the fjord.
Redfern paused, nodding at Pitt.
Then he continued reading. Shortly after we were driven into this long bay, we managed to beach the ship and fall into a dead sleep for 2 days and nights. The god Serapis is unkind. Winter has set in and ice has bound the ship. We have no choice but to brave out the winter until the days warm. A barbarian village lies across the bay, and we have found them open to trade. We barter with them for food. They use our gold coins as trinkets, having no idea of their value. They have showed us how to keep warm by burning oil from a monstrous fish. Our stomachs are full, and I think we shall survive. While I am comfortable with much time on my hands, I will write a few words each day. This entry, I shall recall the amount and type of cargo that Venator slaves unloaded from the hold of the Serapis as I watched unseen from the galley and made an accounting. At the sight of the great object, everyone sank to their knees in proper reverence.
What does he mean? Asked Lily.
Patience, said Redfern. Listen. 320 copper tubes marked geologic charts. 63 large tapestries. These were packed around the grand gold and glass casket of Alexander. My knees trembled. I could see his face through. Rufinus wrote no more, Redfern said sadly. He didn't finish the sentence. The last tablet is a drawing showing the general configuration of the shoreline and the course of the river. The lost coffin of Alexander the Great, Lily said, slightly above a whisper. Can he still lie buried in a cavern somewhere? Along with treasures from the Alexandria Library, Redfern added to Lily's question. We can do little else but hope. Pitt's reaction was quite different. It was one of profound confidence. Hope is for spectators. I figure I can find your antiquities in 20 days. Lily's and Redfern's eyes opened wide. They regarded Pitt with the suspicion usually awarded a politician promising to lower taxes. They flatly didn't believe him. They should have.
You sound pretty cocky, said Lily.
Pitt's green eyes glowed with a look of utter sincerity. Let's have a look at the map. Redfern handed him a rendering Lily had made from the tablet and then enlarged. There was little to examine except a series of wavy lines. Won't tell us much, he said. Rufinus didn't label anything. It's enough, said Pitt, his tone dry and unperturbed. Enough to lead us to the front door. It was 4 in the morning when Pitt awoke. He automatically rolled over to return to sleep, but realized through the cobwebs that someone had turned on the light and was talking to him. Sorry, pal, but you've got to rise and shine. Pitt groggily squinted into the serious face of Commander Knight. What gives? Orders from the top. You're to shove off for Washington immediately. They say why? They is the Pentagon, and no, they didn't grace me with an explanation. Pitt sat up and swung his bare feet onto the deck. I was hoping to hang around a bit longer and watch the excavation. No such luck, said Knight. You, Giordino, and Dr. Sharp have to be on your way within the hour. Lily? Pitt stood and made his way to the head. I can understand the big brass wanting to question Al and me about the Soviet sub, but why are they interested in Lily? The Joint Chiefs don't confide in the serfs, Knight smiled wryly. I haven't a clue. What about transportation? Same way Redfern came in. Helicopter to the Eskimo village and weather station, a Navy plane to Iceland, where you transfer to an Air Force B-52 bomber that's rotating back to the States for overhaul. Not the way it's done, mumbled Pitt with a toothbrush in his mouth. If they want my wholehearted cooperation, it's private jet or nothing. You're pretty heady for this early in the morning. When I'm kicked out of bed before dawn, I'm not shy about telling the Joint Chiefs to insert it among their hemorrhoids. There goes my next promotion, moaned Knight. Guilt by association. Stick with me and you'll wind up Fleet Admiral. I bet. Pitt tapped his head with the toothbrush. Genius has struck. Fire off a message. Say we'll meet them halfway. Giordino and I will fly our pneumocopter direct to Thule Air Force Base. They can damn well have a government jet waiting to zap us to the capital. You might as well tease a Doberman when he's eating. Pitt threw up his hands. Why is it nobody around here has any faith in my creative smarts?